Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View here on Monday evening, May 16th. I'm having some technical difficulties tonight. I'm apologizing here in advance because I'm having some trouble with my Skype and my mic in my mixer, and it's all last minute. I wasn't able to repair it, so I'll hopefully have my tech out here in maybe a day or two to get all this straightened out. But anyway, welcome back. I'm going to have an interesting guest on tonight, which I'll get to in a moment. But as I always pay homage to, not that they expect me to, but because I appreciate people and I always pass that along, is that I always appreciate the free speech that BBSRadio.com encourages us to have and that we have through them. And I'm always thankful for that. And thank goodness for alternative media to bring the message of, or my message of, liberty, property, and peace forward, as I always do. And throughout the world, I hope people are listening. We welcome your calls. You can call the station here at 530-413-4511. That's line one. Or 530-413-4515. As you probably know, the good news is that Ron Paul has formally entered the race, which I was hoping he would. I thought he would, and I'm glad that he has, because now more than ever we need Ron Paul. In fact, all of America should get behind him. Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Libertarians, Communists, Socialists. Wake up, Communists, Socialists. This is the man to support, because he is not a New World Order puppet. He speaks truth to power. He cannot be bought. He's a humble, modest man who will be the first to tell you, as I would, that we are standing on the shoulders of giants. And Ron Paul is all about constitutional government, liberty and property and peace. He doesn't want to disband the military. He wants a military as laid out in the Constitution, as I do, as most of us do. But we don't want to be the world's policeman. Nowhere should the federal government, are they enumerated to be the world's policeman, to have over 700 military bases in over 130 foreign countries. And as Ron Paul says, this trillion-dollar foreign policy is bankrupting our country. So, as I want to say, and proud to say, that the Ron Paul wing of the Republican Party, that is the Jeffersonian constitutional wing of the Republican Party, is where the Republican Party should be. And we all need to get behind Ron Paul. I hope the neocons will wake up and they will get behind Ron Paul. But what I see happening is they will try to marginalize him and ridicule him and say that he's weak on defense and all this nonsense. When Dr. Paul has been more than correct about the economy, foreign policy, and defense, and he's a five-year Air Force veteran. If anybody has the right to speak their minds, it's our vets, because after all, they're out there supposedly defending our freedom. Well, why aren't they treated more like that's what they do? So anyway, Dr. Paul is different this time around because more people know who he is. It's harder to marginalize him. I'm glad that Donald Trump and Huckabee are out of the race. I think the other Pawlenty's such a wimp. Santorum is, Mr. Social Conservative, clueless about so much, yet, very anti-abortion, but doesn't mind blowing up people on the other side of the world and expanding the war. And this country's broke. It's worse than a lot of us think. The unemployment rate's higher. The inflation is higher than they say it is. Yes, I'm spreading some doom and gloom, but I'm telling you the truth. It's like Ron Paul. He doesn't tell you what you want to hear. He tells it like it is. And Americans are going to have to be able to deal with that and face up to it. And you're not going to get anywhere by electing Barack Obama, who's just a very willing New World Order puppet. Just like Bush, he serves the big banks, Wall Street, the military-industrial congressional complex, and the Israeli lobby. So if you want more of the same, that's what Obama's going to give us. It's just more spending, more debt. And when China and other countries stop buying our debt, that's it, folks. So, I believe that Ron Paul, more than ever, it's our only chance, and he can turn things around. He can do a lot of things without the Congress, not as a dictator. He can bring the troops home. He can pardon a lot of people. There's a lot that he can do, and he can steer us down the path of economic liberty and freedom and a sane foreign policy that is based on arms neutrality and free trade. Now, my guest tonight is an interesting fellow, a friend of mine, sort of a newer friend of mine, and he was born in the Middle East, and he spent his childhood, most of his childhood years in Syria, came to this country, I don't know how many years ago yet, I don't recall exactly, but he was born in Cairo, and he's a Lebanese father, Egyptian mother. So he came here. Later on, they came here. He'll tell us more about it. I'm just giving you a little prep for it all. And he became well educated here, and he is has a degree in astrophysics and theoretical physics. So he's definitely a lot smarter than me in math and science. And I will say that about most people. Math and science ain't my thing. But if you want to challenge me in economics, philosophy, political science, geography, history, bring it on. But anyway, his name is Dr. Ray, and he'll be on here soon. If he's not out there already waiting to come on, they'll let me know. But he's an interesting guy, and we're going to speak about the Middle East. We're going to speak about the wars. We're going to speak about Israel and Zionism. We're going to speak about U.S. foreign policy. And the gloves will definitely be off, because that's how I like to do it. And we'll talk about the CIA, which has infiltrated so many things. I didn't realize till about 5 years ago how deeply the tentacles of the CIA are in our government, our military, our universities, in many foreign countries, especially the Middle East. So these are the things that we'll be talking about and slamming on. I see that my guest is here. So I will bring Dr. Ray on, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, the infamous Dr. Ray. Dr. Ray, are you out there, sir? Maybe I've lost him. Perhaps he'll call in again. Okay, I guess I've lost him temporarily. Let me go on further. We're going to, when I get him back on, we're going to be talking about the Middle East and the problems over there, the problems that he sees. He also welcomes your calls about anything about religion in the Middle East, any sort of these questions. He's got a great sense of humor. He hails from, I think, the Boston area originally, and hopefully he's trying to call back in. He might have a degree in astrophysics and physics, but hopefully he knows how to dial in. So that's my bad insulting humor there a little bit. But anyway, yeah, it's interesting talking with him. And as you know, what we'd like to do on this show, or what I like to do on this show, is definitely take the gloves off, because we don't pull any punches here. I name names. I blame certain individuals. And I always put the blame squarely on the federal government, which causes us so many problems at home and abroad. Looks like our guest is back. Dr. Ray, are you out there, sir?
Oh, yes, I am, and I thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Would you like some tea or coffee?
I already brewed a cup of coffee, and I'm
it's self-service here.
Considering it a coffee talk, if you will. Yeah.
It's self-service here. Well, in case you heard, I'm having some trouble tonight with my electronics here. I'm not a wizard with mixers and this electronic stuff. My self-proclaimed brilliance is more in economics and philosophy and sarcasm and just having the balls to tell it like it is. So hopefully I have my tech over here in a day or two. We can straighten this out. So I do apologize. I'm using a different phone. But as long as you can hear me and I can hear you, our wisdom shall flow forth, won't it?
Yes, it will. It will indeed.
So thank you for making yourself available.
Well, you know, it's a privilege and an honor.
It is.
You know, it's a lot of fun to actually discuss things, you know, in regards of anything and everything in regards to the Middle East, because the Middle East is a very fragile place to be in and to be from. So, yeah, I am very thrilled to be on the show, and I thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
For doing such a beautiful
I'm always trying to get interesting guests, and I would love to have a lot of high-profile guests, but I like to have regular folks, too, like you, if you can be considered a regular person with an astrophysics and a theoretical physics degree. But anyway, regular folks, because it's nice to get the input, and unlike neoconservative talk radio, I won't cut you off or go to a commercial or say that, you know, my time's up. You'll get to speak your mind, and because I certainly do. And so you were born in Cairo, Egypt.
Yes, yes, indeed. I was born in Cairo, Egypt, of a Lebanese father and an Egyptian mother. And that is, that's a beautiful thing to be.
That's almost what Omar Sharif's background is, isn't it?
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, yeah. I guess I do have that Omar Sharif. I share something with Omar Sharif.
Well, he's better looking than you are, but you're smarter. So there are trade-offs.
Well, yeah, I guess he is a far more handsome guy than I am, you know. Then again, I don't consider myself a genius or a smart guy. I mean, I'm just
I don't consider you that either. But I know you're a smart guy, and we've spoken a little about foreign policy, and I'd like to remind you and our multitude of listeners, and I like to say this sarcastically, and sort of I put it out as a challenge, and I fault a lot of Americans for this, for not knowing this, because they think we're special, or so many do. They've been led to believe that this American exceptionalism, which I think is nonsensical. But anyway, as I like to say, Dr. Ray, I'm an American who actually knows world geography and world history.
Well, that's impressive.
I actually know that the rest of the world knows more about America than America knows about the world.
I think I know why, too.
Well, because I like to read. I've traveled.
Besides the fact that you read and travel, those are the interests that you have, but also that comes along with the academics that has been presented in the United States. Case in point is what happened to me when I first moved to the United States. Going into schools here, they set me back a few years, considering that I have a lack of knowledge of the American, a schooling system or the academics that require me to do so. Ironically,
well, you should have been ahead of your peers when you got here.
And I was. And how funny is this? I actually was. And it wasn't just me, believe it or not. There was also another Lebanese young lady that was with me in the same class. And we were the aces of the class, ironically. And it turns out because we took that information far before we ever came into class in the United States. I mean, for example, we were studying arithmetic, we were studying geography, and I have to give it to the British system, because the British system, when it comes to education, is far more complex, I would dare say.
They do not
hold anything back in a sense of learning history and, you know, math, and they set the bar a little too higher than the American system. I actually noticed that.
Well, you know, in America, you know, geography and history are two of the lost subjects. And as far as Britain goes, I am quite the Anglophile, but I'm very anti-Churchill. And speaking of the Middle East, he's one of the main reasons that whole place is so messed up.
Well, there's plenty of reasons why.
But if you look at the architects of things, he really pushed for World War I behind the scenes, and then he became beholden to Zionists who helped fund his lavish lifestyle. And of course, he maneuvered England into World War II and the U.S. You know, but one of my biggest heroes remains T.E. Lawrence of Arabia. And if they would have listened to him at Versailles, we wouldn't be in this problem in the Middle East. Because he didn't want to colonize.
That's exactly what I was going to point out. Is Lawrence of Arabia, believe it or not, he's the one who really understood the situation and how fragile it was, and True. His recommendation was dead on. The only problem is they was brushed under the, you know, under the rug, and they always looked at it as, well, you know, what is this guy talking about? He was just hanging out with some Arabs, so obviously he have some sort of, you know, emotions that would come in play. And so why would you pay attention to some guy who is fascinated with the Arab countries and the Arab world and you know, the Arab way or the lifestyle that they live in? To them, it was just another guy who was fascinated.
Well, they pay attention to him because he was brilliant and needed his help. He was a brilliant map maker. He spoke fluent Arabic and French. So yeah, at the time, they needed him, but they stabbed him in the back because he found out later on that, you know, he liked the Arab people. He wanted them to be independent. He didn't want them to go on, you know, go from Turkish rule to under, you know, colonial or European rule. And that, you know, he carried that pain with him all the rest of his life.
Well, you know, that's exactly why, you know, I think it's interesting you pointed that out because
of course it is.
It was all the Lawrence of Arabia era that was the one that really, really, really was the time the Arab world started to deteriorate, politically speaking, that is.
Yeah, true, true.
You know, and it's really interesting how you pointed that out because that's exactly what I was going to actually point out myself. But you stole that from me.
Well, thank you. And at this point, I'd like to ask you: I'm pretty smart and worldly for a native-born American, aren't I?
Well, yes, because you know, if you know where Lebanon exists on the map, as far as I'm concerned, that makes you a brilliant person because a lot of people think Lebanon is the next town over. Somewhere in Massachusetts or probably out in Nevada, because they do exist. Only it's not the town, we're talking about the country. So they obviously
True.
Mix the two.
And I even know, well, there's a Lebanon in Indiana, but I even know that Lebanon was formerly Phoenicia, a nation of great sailors and mariners and traders.
Yes, that's very, very true. Mm-hmm. Our history is, you know, reeks with travel and trade. And
right.
It's interesting that that's probably why you find the Lebanese next to your doorstep or on your doorstep almost everywhere you go around the world is because it's in their nature to travel, I believe. Being a native, Lebanese native, is sort of one of those things that come along with it, is that
yeah.
you have to travel. You have to do it.
And I certainly like their food. Lebanese
oh, thank
cooking,
you.
Middle East cuisine, and of course, I've enjoyed Lebanese hashish, and so you know, I enjoy the things that your mother country has to offer, and all the Lebanese people I've met were very nice. I understand what about a third of the country is Christian, and the rest are Muslim.
Well, the numbers now have changed. It used to be
now?
Back in the day. Yeah, back in the day, and by that I mean in the era of, in the 20s, per se, the Christians were the dominant force because they were the dominant number.
Really?
And, and that recently decreased because of, you know, political mishaps and bad decision-making politically. And with that said, of course, it deteriorated a country and it got into a civil war. The Christians became the weaker part of the fight. And
what
so
year are you
they,
talking civil? Sorry, what year civil war?
I'm talking about the civil war that started in the 70s. Well, to be more precise, in the 80s, because in the 70s it was a national war. The entire country was going against the Palestinians who supposedly invaded. But that's not necessarily the point.
Sorry, let's back up. You mean there was a clashing between the Lebanese and the Palestinians?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Is that because
Absolutely.
The Palestinians went to Lebanon as refugees?
Not exactly. You know, the story is quite ridiculous, but it happened. And if you ask any Lebanese at any faith, will probably reside the same thing I'm telling you right now. It started off with a bus full of Palestinian refugees who wanted to cross through a parade that Al-Kataib, which was a political party, if you will, they were doing a parade that day. Well, they insisted on passing through, and obviously they denied them that. Somehow gunshots flew around, and killed some people, and obviously that bus never made it out of there. But some survivors went and got more people with more guns, and that was exactly the spark of the war. That's what happened. And then that escalated into, you know, the Palestinians are staying here as refugees. They're supposed to stay here with their respect, and they denying the fact. They think that, you know, they own the country. And so that's the understanding. That's the national understanding of the Palestinian situation. So in retaliation, we wanted them out, supposedly. And, of course, that right there segregated the Christians and the Muslims almost immediately.
Well, now, is 82 when Israel intervened? How did they get into the picture? Our wonderful, peaceful, honest Israeli friends. How did this happen?
Well, you know, they did not. It's funny because their intervention was not directed towards the Lebanese, you know, in any sense. It was, they were chasing the Palestinians.
I thought they sided with the Lebanese Christian. Was it Falange gangs or something?
Right, and they did because at the time, the Falange gang didn't have any power. In that sense, they did have militia, you know, political power, and but at the same time, they failed to execute in a flawless fashion, and it was a bloodbath. So they needed some sort of Air Force, Navy, and they couldn't get any of that rolling fast enough. So obviously they resided to the Jews for help, and that by that I mean, of course, the Israeli government.
Sounds like they executed a lot of people in a smooth fashion.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I, for one, don't look at Israel as an immediate threat to Lebanon. Because Israel,
I look at it as a threat to the Israel, world and the Middle East.
Well,
and America.
That's kind of arguable. But, you know, Zionism is everywhere. Let's face it. It's here in this country. It's almost everywhere you look around the globe.
It's infiltrated Judaism, and it's poisoned the Jewish religion, as I see it.
Right.
Zionist. It's atheistic.
Absolutely.
And they're using, you know, Judaism as their cover, their shield. That's how
indeed.
I see it.
And, you know, it's interesting you pointed that out.
I stand with Jews united against Zionism. And I believe I've read what they stand for. I'm totally with them. They might be a small minority, but that doesn't mean they're right about things.
Well, you see, that's the thing. To me personally, I try not to side with one group or another because everybody has a point and everybody is fighting for a cause. And everybody has a reason to do what they do.
Yes, but Israel has their endless supply of American aid and free American-made murder weapons. So they're using our taxes, and they're not our 51st state, and it's nowhere in the Constitution is the American taxpayer supposed to support Israel endlessly. So, you know, I take it further than Ron Paul, but Ron Paul wants to cut off all foreign aid to everybody, and I totally agree. You know, he says the Arabs get more than Israel does. Well, you know, when you stack it together, I guess they do. But they have nowhere near the power that Zionists do in our country and you know, globally.
Well, you got to look at who holds the string of pearls in the United
the
States.
Rothschilds.
Really. Indeed. And how do they hold the string of pearls is by having enough wealth.
Well, through their banking system.
Somewhat,
their league with the Rothschilds.
Exactly. Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny because they have your money in their pocket and they use it to do whatever they want to do with it.
Yeah, and I'm sick of it.
regardless of that point, see, the whole entire Middle East situation is very fragile.
Of course
I dare say it's extremely fragile. And it's not because of Israel, to be direct, but it's interesting how there was animosity amongst Arabs themselves. And
well,
this goes
amongst
back
themselves
in,
as tribes.
Well, no. I don't mean it. You know, I don't mean it in a sense of tribal sense. No, of course, I mean it in a religious sense. Arabs,
Shiite versus Sunni.
Throughout, yes, of course, the Shiite, the Sunni, the Alawites. You know, it's the Druze. I mean, boy, it's It's a quite a jungle out there.
As I'm fond of saying, the U.S., let's talk about the U.S. now. The U.S. had no enemies in the Middle East prior to 1948 when Israel was violently imposed on Palestine. And ever since then, the U.S. has been aiding Israel and, you know, funding it, and this has been the major problem ever since then. So I blame Israel for about 75% of the problem. And the Palestinians had nothing to do with the Holocaust in World War II, and they've suffered tremendously because of this.
Oh, by the way, speaking of, congratulations to the Israeli state. It's been, what, 40-some years now? They just celebrated their independence.
Yeah. And what they did to the Palestinians is just awful. And by the way, do you know what one Palestinian woman said to the other Palestinian woman?
No.
Does this bomb make my butt look too big? Do you know the difference between an Arab terrorist and an Israeli terrorist?
Well, I would assume one is a Jew and the other one is a Muslim.
But yes, doctor. No, the Israeli terrorist would have kept the wheelchair.
Yeah, but see,
little Achille Lauro joke for you there.
Oh yeah, that went right on top of me for a minute there. No, but
thank
you see, you know, I sincerely insist that you know times have changed, Arabs have changed. You know, and you know, it's interesting that you pointed out, you know, that 75% of the problem is Israel.
I think
yes,
so.
Back then. No, indeed, back then. But now, it's lately, Israel has been coming out and doing something totally odd, that the Arabs are getting mixed emotions, or rather, mixed signals. For example, which brings us to Syria, or what's happening to Syria right now. A lot of people are pointing out that Syria, or what's happening into Syria, are a bunch of people who are being paid, such as mercenaries, and they are shooting the people under false flag pretenses that is being dressed in an army outfit.
I'm sure.
And
I wouldn't be surprised if they're not funded by Mossad. And CIA.
But wait a minute. That's exactly where everyone thought that. Everyone. Every Arab that we knew or I've spoken to said, Israel is right behind it. How ironic. Israel right now has been a very key, important role in what happened in Syria because they surrendered the evidence to those who are behind it. And it turns out it wasn't the Jews, it wasn't Israel, it wasn't the Zionistic company. Ironically, it was an old enemy that has come afar, and that is Saudi Arabia.
Is that because there's a lot of Shiites in Lebanon? Syria.
Oh yes,
Shiites,
oh absolutely,
friend of
oh,
Iran,
absolutely.
Right?
Oh yes, indeed. No, because see, the Bashar al-Assad, which is the president there currently, he's an Alawite. Alawites and Shiites are predominantly the same,
uh-huh.
And Saudi Arabia has a big, big problem, and it's called the Shiite, because they're all Sunni. And the Sunni and the Shiites have animosity that goes back years through the days of infancy of Islam.
Isn't it sort of like the the 16th century or 17th century in Europe where the Protestants and Catholics were killing each other? Similar to that.
As a matter of fact, it was a little even further than that, because the separation of Islam between Sunni and Shiite happened directly after the death of the Prophet Muhammad.
Uh-huh.
And now we're talking about Islam in its infancy. And by infancy, I mean as a structured religion.
Is this about 600 A.D.?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Pretty good, huh? I'm pretty smart, huh?
Oh, yes, you're right on. So the point I'm trying to get across is that Israel, for once, they did the right thing. They assisted the Syrian government into proving that not that they had nothing to do with it, that they proved who did it, which actually plays a very important role. Now, we can look at it in two different ways. We can look at it as, are they adding more fuel to the fire, which could be a yes, or are they assisting the Alawites for once? And I take it that they are assisting the Alawites for once, because Israel came out and said it flat out straight. We do not benefit from the fall of the government in Syria. Reason is because the new government under Bashar al-Assad has came to almost negotiation talks, while previously his predecessor, and that would be his father,
right,
would not even talk to Syria. Israel.
He was quite a prick, wasn't he, his old man?
Well, his old man was a very iron-fisted person.
Yeah, yeah.
He wanted what he wanted, and he didn't get what he wanted, then off with you.
Yeah.
And that was the approach that he approached his politics. You know, his regime was based on that. Now you get this new guy who is open-minded, educated, traveled around the world, started to see the value of individualism, not necessarily, becoming more of a stereotype. And, I believe he started to negotiate with Israel by saying, listen, give us back the Golan Heights, and we'll discuss peace treaty.
But the Golan
right
Heights
after
is
that.
Lebanese. Isn't Golan Heights Lebanese territory?
No, actually, it's Syrian territory.
Really? Because when I'm thinking of the map right now, I thought it was on the bottom of Lebanon.
Yes, but also bordering Syria, and technically, that is Syrian.
Oh, okay.
Technically.
Okay.
Technically. And so, they fought tooth and nail to get the Golan Heights, during the wars. But it came to a point where, they required a peace treaty talk. And how ironic it happens to be right around when, I'm talking about a year ago. They started talking on a peace treaty, and they started discussing the Golan Heights, to surrender the Golan Heights back to the Syrian government. Now, as of January, the people of Tunisia, of course, they started the whole thing.
Yeah,
exactly, got the ball rolling. And obviously, it was a perfect opportunity for Saudi Arabia to overthrow the power in Syria by making it look like everybody's, appalled. But really, people there are not appalled. As a matter of fact, they really like Bashar, and he's a very good president, believe it or not. He really cares for his country. He's been very fair. He changed a lot, and he's in the process of bringing Syria to the 21st century.
Well, that's good.
You see, and that's a very good thing. So as far as the people are concerned, they're saying, no, we don't want to overthrow the government. Granted, we don't want it to become a kingdom where the father goes and the son takes over. The old king is dead, long live the king. They don't want that system, but they cannot afford to overthrow the government as of now anyway, because the country is on the flourishing boom.
Well, a monarchy is not necessarily a bad thing, as long as the king holds.
Oh no! It's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not a bad thing.
The king and queen.
Well, but you see, that's the point I'm trying to point out. They don't want it to be in a monarchy. They don't want it to be a kingdom. The whole entire history of Syria was based on freedom to the people, a republic, if you will.
Go ahead.
After having almost four different presidents within 6 month span, one government overthrown, the other one overthrown, and so on and so forth, until the father, which is Hafez al-Assad, took over, he ruled with an iron fist, because he quickly learned that if I were to throw over a government and become president, I would have to not do the same thing my predecessors have done, is to fail into being overthrown. So obviously he needed to become an iron-fisted person. Now, with that said, that brought some stability in the region. And I'm talking extreme stability with that iron fist mentality that he had.
Right.
And by, you know, stability, I mean he set the fear in everybody's heart so nobody dared to do anything stupid. Or for that matter, do anything.
When I think of Syria...
Which was brilliant.
When I think of Syria, I always think of two words from Lawrence of Arabia. Damascus, Lawrence. Damascus, Lawrence. I guess that was a big thing to get there because that was sort of like the kingdom that the Arabs of the time looked towards.
Right.
Damascus. Well, interesting. Now, we can jump around on the show as we do because I'm so smart, I can go to many different things. And if you're smart, you can follow along. Now, having the U.S., as you know, whacked Osama bin Laden 2 weeks ago. I think it's two weeks ago. Which I was totally against. I mean, I didn't think they had to kill him. I don't believe there was a firefight. I think they wanted to definitely kill him because Osama is a former CIA-paid asset. This way, dead men tell no tales. I would much rather have seen him put on trial in The Hague to speak. And for the record, which I think I'm right about, in fact, I think I'm so right about this, I would bet your life on it, is that Osama bin Laden had next to nothing to do with 9/11. He was the bogeyman. He's the person to blame. He's dead. You know, he don't talk. You know, Saddam is dead. Noriega, former CIA payroll, he's in jail in, you know, in Miami. Saddam, obviously, former CIA payroll. So let me mention Osama's three main demands. And the things that he demanded of the U.S., I completely agree with, and they all, believe it or not, fall into the constitutional duties of our government if they were adhered to. Shall we go? Shall we proceed?
Oh, and indeed. Dive right in.
Okay. Number one, he wanted all U.S. troops off of Saudi Arabian soil. I totally agree. Number two, he wanted the U.S. federal government to stop supporting and propping up Muslim dictators and tyrants throughout the Middle East and the Muslim world. I have no problem with that. That's constitutional, too. That's non-intervention. There's no constitutional authority for the U.S. to be the world's policeman and to use the CIA to run roughshod all these over these countries behind the scenes. Number three, Osama wanted the U.S. federal government to stop supporting and propping up Israel and oppressing the Palestinians. That's number three. I see no contradiction in the U.S. adhering to all three of those because it's constitutional to stay out of those other people's problems, to not to intervene, and not to try to police the world, and not to prop up Israel. So I'm totally with him on those three things.
Yeah, but you know, there is nothing wrong with the demands.
I'm not saying
there is
other terrorist acts in Africa or elsewhere, but that's not what I'm talking about right now.
I know exactly what you're saying, and I totally support your concept. It pulls back,
it cuts and runs. That stupid saying. It doesn't mean that at all. It means that it follows the Constitution.
Well, see, here's the thing. to actually demand
checkmate,
such a thing
baby.
Is one thing. No, just please hear me out.
To
demand such a thing is a wonderful and lovely thing. To put political pressure, that would be arguably the proper channel. But to become a cold-blooded murderer, that right there constitutes terrorism.
That's true. But
do you see what I'm getting at? I mean,
the federal government is a cold-blooded murderer, but they have it wrapped up in patriotism.
Wait a minute. It's a cold-blooded murder, indeed. Yes. Okay, I'm not arguing the point, but what I'm trying to get at here is that we use the proper channels at one point or another. Do you see what I'm getting at?
No, I don't.
At
I don't see what the proper channels are besides bombing people and blowing the hell out of them.
Yeah, but you know what? We have the United Nations to complain to. We have the United Nations to control. We have the United Nations to go through the proper channels. Those are the proper channels. You see, if Saddam Hussein, particularly Saddam, which he was on the payroll of the CIA, and yes, he did execute orders from the Americans directly into doing whatever they're bidding.
But however, Obama hated him,
here's
though.
What happened. But here's what happened. The minute he said no, obviously, they painted him in blood. Now, with Osama, Osama didn't say no. Osama took the fight to their doorstep. That constituted war. Do you see what I'm getting at? It's a contradiction. You
see,
and that's exactly...
It's not because they hate us for our freedom. That's not why.
No. But see, then again, don't forget there is a big contradiction within the Osama trilogy, if you will.
Sure.
Osama used Islam in a sense of, listen, we will not take any oppression from any other faith but Sunni Islamist, period.
Sure.
So he had an agenda aside from what he wanted, you know, and he used that to his benefit to brainwash a lot of young minds who are not afraid to go kill themselves in the name of martyrism. Now, that to me, or to you for that matter, I'm sure anybody that kills anyone and is not afraid to die, you know, there's something wrong there, okay? To not fear death, there's something absolutely wrong. You know, but how do you convince a man to do such a thing? You would have to be very, very, very convincing. And you would have to use some sort of... See, my problem with, not Islam, per se, but my problem is with religion. Humanity's worst enemy is religion. Because you can use it to do good things, and you can use it to do bad things. It's a very strong weapon, and it's a weapon that is used, it's much like a bow and arrow. You can go hunt with it so you can feed your family, or you can go kill some other guy just because you're pissed off at him.
Sure, sure.
So religion is no different than a bow and arrow, if you really look at it, or for that matter, a gun.
The Muslim world has reasons, a couple centuries of reasons to be pissed off at the West, primarily Britain, France, Spain, Holland, because they have colonized, they have invaded, occupied, and colonized Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Saudi, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, and Holland, of course,
and the left
Indonesia.
Goes on and on. Of course, oh,
so,
yeah.
So there are reasons for this, and if Americans, especially if they don't understand history, which is asking a lot. And with their attention span of video games and shopping and sports, then they'll never get it. If they didn't just attack us because they hate our freedom, there are lingering reasons and propping up Israel. So I also believe, in a sense, that Osama won because Osama bin Laden said he wanted to bankrupt the U.S. by bogging them down in wars on Muslim soil and Muslim lands. And look at our country.
Well... You know, I don't see that Osama really won, to be honest with you. But
in a
you know,
sense he won.
I see your point. He hit our pocket somehow. He did
massively.
And he managed. He managed
somehow
to cost
over $1 trillion, and they want to spend more.
Yeah, but see that right there is the point that now we're getting into an interesting point. Look at it this way.
Point. But wait,
hear me out. Wait one second. You see, here's the thing. With Obama, for example, you know, I'm not a big fan of Obama, but Obama actually highlighted a very, very important thing when he was addressing the Arab nations in Cairo at his speech. And he said, and I quote, Afghanistan is a war of necessity. And Iraq was a war of choice.
I don't agree.
That is a very important thing to say. I think that was, you know, he highlighted something that was crucial. You have to look at it in that retrospect as well. You know, Iraq is the biggest money guzzler in the United States military. Or back then it was.
Well, you know what Iraq stands
now,
for, don't you?
Oh, well, of course I do. Now,
okay.
Well, you look at it this way. What's really pathetic is the Bush administration sent in a very small number to wage war in Afghanistan, and the rest of the troops, which is over, I would greatly say, over 70% of the troops, went to Iraq, and the other 30 were in Afghanistan.
Well,
if you really are a war, you know, if you're really waging a war on terror and you're trying to fight, in, you know, the Taliban and Al Qaeda in Afghanistan, obviously you would send most of your power there, not the lack of.
No,
believe it or not, a lot
either.
Of troops that came back from, you know, I spoke to a lot of troops that coming in from Afghanistan, and you know what their biggest number complaint, the number one complaint they said, we don't get enough support. Well,
no.
If you're going to fight the war on terror and taking the fight to the terrorist, you would support that. You would give it and nourish it and fight it, tooth and nail. But the problem is, the Bush administration put us in a very, very, very deep, 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 and I'm talking so deep of a hole, it's not even funny, of how really, 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 really suffering money. And we fought a war in Iraq on a loan. That's how bad it got.
I, even 10 years ago, I would, here's where I use the Constitution again. I said at the time, well, on 9/11, I said the chickens have come home to roost. I said that, meaning foreign policy, it's come back to haunt us, blowback. And I would have sent, when I used to think Osama bin Laden had something to do with it, whoever did, I wouldn't have bombed the hell out of Afghanistan. That's ridiculous, harming all those or killing so many innocent people. I would have sent in, you know, this is where you need James Bond and spies and infiltration to do this. this is what you need
insects,
to get
right?
these people. Not blowing the hell out of villages and countries.
No, I agree with you.
Iraq, which stands for Idiotic Republican Authorized Quagmire, or Israeli required American quagmire. Israel didn't like Saddam had the largest Arab military in the Middle East.
But you see, what I'm trying
and
to get
they,
at, no, but see, I think you misinterpreted what I'm saying.
And they want the U.S.
Play.
To attack Iran also. There's no reason to attack Iran.
Agreed, but see, what I'm trying to get at here is not, that's not the point that I was trying to point out. What I'm trying to point out here is that, assuming that the war of choice versus a war of necessity was to be in Afghanistan, you would obviously do the common sense. Common sense would say that you would send in most of your troops. Just to go to show you that the whole entire thing has been nothing but a smokescreen. Oh, we're going to fight back. Oh, we're going to go kill people, and we're going to say they did it. Well, let me tell you this, and this is common sense, and I'm not reciting something out of the movie Loose Change in any way, but this is it's really common sense. No one on the planet has ever rammed a plane into any building and fell within the next 2 hours. That never happened in the history of time. Ironically,
there's no way
two buildings,
those planes brought down those buildings alone.
Indeed. So this has to do some sort of black ops right there, right off the top of the mind.
Well,
I mean, you know, this
strike.
Has to be some sort of black ops.
I think it was mostly Mossad was deeply involved and probably some elements of the CIA. Look who it benefited. More weaponry, more support for Israel, and a much further expanded military-industrial complex. Obama has just, you know, recently signed the largest military budget ever. And I totally disagree about sending a massive force into Afghanistan. They haven't learned from Alexander, the British, or the Russians. Again, there's no uniformed army, you know, to attack. And the question I always like to throw out in this war of the supposed war on terror is, what army, navy, or air force is there for Uncle Sam to fight and or defeat? And please tell me just exactly who is going to surrender.
Oh, who's going to surrender? Well, you know, no one's going to surrender, obviously. Islam extremists specifically, if you want to get to that, as, you know, extremists are the ones who are taking the blame for it. And they should, to be honest with you, because the extremists do have bad intentions. You know, I've come across a lot of people, believe it or not, I actually mentioned it in my bio, where I was sitting down with a bunch of friends who did not know that I was of a different faith. And, you know, and they were discussing it as if it's very casual. You know, one day we're going to take over the world, you know it, and it's the plan is in progress. You mean to tell me that Islam is going to become the number one religion in the world? I mean, is this the agenda that you are planning on? Yeah, come hell or high water, we're going to kill them all. What do you mean kill them all? This is ridiculous.
Well,
you know,
I don't see that happening at all.
No, but you know, but wait a minute. This happened on numerous occasions. That's the problem. And it's not the same people on random people that I've came across.
Yeah, but
and it's really, you know, I mean, I really genuinely believe that there is an Islamic agenda. And
well,
the extremists are the ones who's executing it.
But China and India certainly would stand in the way of that. And I don't believe that's
exactly.
going to happen at all. It might be proposed by some of the radicals.
I totally agree with you, but see, that's how the radicals are thinking.
And now that the Soviet Union's gone, you know, terrorism is the great new way to spend more money and to keep the people scared. Look what's happening to our country. We're losing civil liberties right and left. TSA. You know, TSA stands for thousands of sexual aggressors or thousands of stupid a-holes. So, so this is what's happened. But back to Afghanistan, if they would have sent in, you know, commandos, undercover espionage, that would have been the way to do it. It would have cost us. It wouldn't have cost us $1 trillion, nor all the bloodshed, all the lives. You know, bounty hunters, or they could have put a reward out. Here's $1 billion for who brings us Osama, dead or alive. You know, that would be much better. You know, I mean, at this point, I'm harassing Gaddafi. I want Gaddafi left alone. I want them to leave the guy alone.
You know, but it's funny you mentioned that because I proposed a very, 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 you know, jokatively to a friend of mine or a colleague of mine, if you will. And I said, you know, if they didn't kill Osama, it would have been funny if they would have brought him to the United States and they can come out, you know, we can come out of recession really quickly by simply charging $1 spit.
Yeah,
if you spit at him, you charge you a dollar, and we'll get out of recession really quickly.
My solution would have been also constitutional because, as Ron Paul speaks about, the Constitution speaks of letters of marque and reprisals to go get the bad guy. You know,
commandos are a small force
to do it, not bomb the hell out of the country.
SEAL Team 6 is a small force. SEAL Team 5 is a small force.
There's 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. That's not what I mean.
But I see what you're saying, and I know exactly what you mean. But see, what I'm trying to point out is that you are putting way too much small forces all at once, and that obviously constitutes into a big full-on war. And I agree with what you're saying, yes. But see, here's where it gets a little interesting. How long did it take for them to find Osama?
It took them 10 years.
10 years on the hunt for Osama. You mean to tell me that is actually sufficient evidence to prove that finally we find Osama from October, and for the past 10 years he's been in hiding? I highly doubt that. I highly doubt that completely. As you and I are talking right now, the CIA, the FBI, and hell, who knows else what other, national security is listening to us. You see, but here's where it gets quite interesting. We got satellites to zoom in on a dime and literally show you in clarity a photo of that dime showing you the imprint of what year it's been printed. And you mean to tell me we couldn't find one guy? One guy. That be if he was involved in September 11th. You see what I'm saying? So there's a lot of distorted information that's coming in and out for the past 10 years. I believe the U.S. hid him all along. I believe the CIA was hiding him all along.
I wouldn't be surprised. And also now, they can say whatever they want they found on the hard drive. They can make up stories left and right. I don't believe anything they have to say.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Look, you know, I do believe he died. I do believe he died.
I do, too. I also believe that those bastards had orders just to kill him, not to take him back. You know, and I think
ordered to kill him, yes.
And I believe that they probably did bury him at sea, but they should not have killed him. No way. They put Saddam on trial, and I was against Saddam's execution.
But see, wait a minute. What they should have done, and this is the proper way to do this, is to trial him, and then surrender him to, the Saudi authorities.
The Hague.
Now, him being a Wahhabi, which is very, very important, key element into the trial, him being a Wahhabi and Saudi Arabia considering him a terrorist, obviously he would have gotten hung, or for that matter, with head cut off. And he would have been buried in a grave unmarked, because that's the Wahhabi way.
Uh-huh.
You don't mark the grave, period. So
that's a radical.
The outcome is the same.
That's a radical.
It's not radical.
Muslim sect, isn't it?
Yes, they are. They are radicals. The Wahhabis are radicals. You got the other radicals there, the Salafiyin, which is also, you know, they're very radical. So, and they all reside in Saudi Arabia. Now, that would have been the proper way of handling it. But then again, the Obama administration wanted one and only thing. One and only thing.
And
kill
the scary thing
Osama.
Is, I think that's going to get him reelected. I would much rather have 4 years of Osama bin Laden alive and well than four more years of Obama.
But see, that's exactly. But wait a minute, now that we're getting into, you know, we're getting into, we're veering off the subject. But
really.
Yes, where is Obama's legacy? I ask you.
Big spending, huge deficits, massive government spending
that's
more than
legacy.
Bush in a short
No. That's not a legacy. Wait a minute, that's not a legacy.
It's a terrible
legacy. I'm talking on a positive legacy. His legacy.
Oh, he got Osama bin Laden.
Exactly, and that's exactly the plan. They've had him under his note. The CIA always had him. They hid him, you know. And they've always keep tabs on him, and they know exactly where he's at. And whenever it was convenient for whoever's president, they can just pull the plug on it. And that's exactly what the Obama administration did. They wanted to get reelected, and that's his legacy. Oh yeah, we got Osama on Obama's watch. You see, now, which brings me to the next point. Is it fair? No, of course it's not fair. Is it smart? Indeed it is. There's no doubt about it. It's brilliant. It's a very smart way to get elected because his numbers in the polls are terrible. When your numbers are terrible, you got to pull something off. Case in point, which is what happened to the Bush administration. I honestly think the Bush administration had something to do with the 9/11. Do you recall?
I think Cheney did. I don't think Bush did, because Cheney ordered a NORAD stand down, as you know.
No. Wait a minute. You can't put two butt cheeks in one underwear and call it different.
It's part of it. It's part of how it came down. Plus all the intelligence reports they kept ignoring. Look, I'll do the jokes here, Dr. Ray.
Yeah, but you know, PK, you keep forgetting a very, very key point. What I'm trying to get at here is that the Bush administration needed a distraction really desperately to come out of the missing boxes here in Florida when it came down to the re-elections, or the elections for that matter. So they needed a distraction quickly to get your mind off of how he stole the presidency. Let's face it. This is exactly what happened. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is history as we know it. I'm not making this up. Look back into the time and you'll see it. All of a sudden, the Bush, you know, George W. Bush, not really elected president. It wasn't really official, right? And then all of a sudden, September 11th happened. Directly after that, not even a week later, the boxes were found.
Well, listen, my friend.
What does that tell you?
It tells me, Dr. Ray, that I've got to wind things down now. This hour goes rather quickly, but thank you for enlightening us to a lot of things about the Middle East and your take on things. Once again, I appreciate you coming on. I hope you'll come back again so we can continue our lively conversation.
Well, indeed. And I thank you very much for having me on.
My producers are telling me I got to wind things down now, and they're watching the clock for me. So I'm going to thank you again for coming on to Third Stream View. Appreciate it so much, and we'll talk again soon. I'm going to say goodnight to you now, my friend. You take care.
You as well.
I appreciate your work indeed. Okay?
Absolutely. I appreciate your work indeed, really. And it's fun to listen and talk to you. It's been a privilege and an honor, like I said. And
Shalom, baby. Shukran.
Yeah, you know, that's it. That's it.
Okay. And with that, I'm going to say thanks again to bbsradio.com. This is your wonderful host, humble host, PK, signing off, saying that I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, 9 o'clock Pacific, 11 o'clock Central, 12 a.m. Eastern, here at Third Stream View. Good night, everybody.